everybody. I'm Tom Mantione, and I'm excited to welcome Greg Poole, Managing Director and Global Head of Content Distribution, which in and of itself is incredible. So Greg joined UBS in April of 2016 and took on the task of finding and packaging UBS's content across global markets. And an interesting thing happened in the beginning of the pandemic. Greg, much like Andrew and I, decided to get out there in front of people. Andrew and I decided to write a Saturday note, and for some crazy unforeseen reason, which he probably regrets, Greg decided to do a daily call at 8:30 in the morning. So every single day, Greg is scouring UBS for content on the markets in a much more tactical way. And he's going to talk about what the Knowledge Network is, how he built said Knowledge Network, and the humor behind his morning radio show at 8:30. So, Greg, I'm going to ask you straight away, what is UBS's Knowledge Network?
Great. Tom, thank you. Jill, thank you for getting this organized, and hopefully look forward to a bunch of questions for the audience, right? So the Knowledge Network, or KNET for short, as you said, is the content engine for global markets and the broader investment bank, but increasingly more and more of UBS. Now, in KNET, we really focus on five things. And those five things are trying to answer the questions that you all, our clients, ask the most. And in big picture, I think those questions are, what do we think about risk, right? So what's the market backdrop? Where do we have edge? Where do we actually have unique insight into those risks? What do positioning and flows look like? As I'm sure you have all seen, right? Like even today, right? Like these were very strong retail sales numbers. By all rights, we probably should have sold off because people would be worried about the Fed raising rates and maybe the 2-year needs to climb ever higher. Why didn't that happen, right? That's a positioning story. Flows, right? What are the institutional crowd doing? And we can get into this and hopefully somebody will ask, but we're forensic on how we think about flows and positioning. And then last, how's performance? Because performance matters for people's willingness and ability to take risk. Now, Tom, the next thing that I say about the Knowledge Network, it is no one person at UBS knows the answer to all of that. Collectively, as an organization, we have a really well-informed opinion on almost every single market debate. And it's my job and my team's job to find that subject matter expert on a daily, weekly, monthly basis and try and bring that to bear. And so that subject matter expertise ranges across, again, all of UBS. If the debt ceiling comes up, right, we've got two unique resources, John Savercool, who's kind of our head lobbyist, for lack of a better word, and Jeb Hensarling, right? So Jeb had a ringside seat to the last time the debt debate got really nasty. When it's volatility, right, the person that I want the most is Jeff Yu. Jeff manages our option trading business and down the line. So that's the goal of KNET, and that's how we've set it up.
So let's take one piece of that first and kind of start the debate with it. So a lot of times our clients are hearing, well, it's risk on, risk off. This is what's happening. And you started one of the things with, what do you think about risk? So when you're thinking about that question, where are you looking for answers?
Sure. So the two brightest stars in the network are CIO team and the global markets research team, right? So lots of it starts there between those two strategies. But then when it's a particular topic, right, inflation, we were all over the inflation story because, as it turns out, the person who heads our inflation business in global markets or in the investment bank spent 15 years at the Fed setting the inflation forecast. His name is Alan Detmeister. So he's got a really well-informed opinion. in the investment
bank. Also a very apropos last name.
Exactly. It's perfect. So then when it comes to trading, again, UBS has the largest TIPS trading franchise. Her name is Wei Wei Tan. And so we start there. So I a little bit reverse engineer it, right? Mm-hmm. So give me the subject, right? And I can tell you who our subject matter expert is. Mm-hmm. And then also, right, the team, we cover some of the largest macro hedge funds, maybe some of the more sophisticated multi-asset funds. And so a lot of this starts really with client questions. And honestly, Tom, the call that I hold for you and your team, a lot of it starts with those questions.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously the debate, or maybe not so obvious, right? We had this conversation in our pre-work for this call. You know, last week we had Chair Powell talk about the disinflation process has begun. And then, of course, yesterday we got inflation data that was slightly higher than expected, followed by retail sales figures today. Where is the debate headed now? I mean, Andrew and I were just talking before you got on the call. It seems like the market is now pricing in more than what the Fed is indicating.
Yep.
What do we think about that?
So we think a bunch about it, and I'm struggling in my head to say, like, how do I want to answer this? And in what order do I want to go? So when I start to talk too much, say, you know, take a breath or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the most controversial thing that I'm going to say today, and I was talking with our head of risk about this morning. So just again, for the audience, every Wednesday, I host a meeting with the heads of trading in each of the asset classes. And we talk about, you know, again, risk, edge, positioning, flows, et cetera. So I started to say in today's meeting that actually the rates market and the equities market are actually telling us the same thing. Believe it or not, they're both actually rational. It's just they're telling us the thing that we thought was going to be the least likely at the beginning of the year. So let me unpack that. This year, the story is markets are driven by this race between how fast inflation is going to fall versus how quickly growth slows and what's priced in for recessionary risks. Now, go back to October, November, December, even beginning of January, and we, along with almost every firm out there, including our clients, were convinced that we were going to have a hard landing. Mm. And more importantly, we were positioned for it.
Mm.
Now, what's happened since then, right? China was uninvestable. It was never going to reopen. Well, it reopened and it's totally investable. Europe was going to have an energy crisis.
Almost guaranteed to be in a recession in Europe, right?
Yep. And fortunately, right, it's been remarkably warm. The energy coffers were filled. And the latest European data is definitively that we're not in a recession. The housing market was going to roll over in the U.S. It sputtered, right? But home builder confidence has increased. Traffic is increasing. The jobs data clearly better than anybody expected.
Mm-hmm.
And in the months of certainly December and January, we got the benefit of easing financial conditions and falling inflation. So those easing of financial conditions helped the market by our math by about 11%. The growth impulse from China helped by another 2%, and that offset some of the weakening data and falling earnings. And so, again, if it was a race between, you know, how fast inflation falls, well, it was falling really fast. Growth was slowing, but not as slow as we thought. And we started to price in a soft landing. And again, by our math, 4150 on the S&P 500 kind of framed that soft landing scenario. And we actually, again, it's from our strategy team, but looking at like market internals and what stocks are working and what stocks don't work, et cetera, we now only point to like a 10 to 15% probability of a recession in the next 12 months. So that caught everybody by surprise, especially when we were positioned for a recession in the first part of the year. Now, I promised to take. Oh, do you want to ask a follow-up?
I remember an old adage that the markets predicted 15 of the last three
right.
recessions, or something like that. Right.
Yep.
So, this is another one of those moments where we traded as if we were going to have a really hard landing and a significant recession in 2022, and then here we are. So that makes me think about your third question, right? Positioning, because what we've seen so far this year has been a massive sector rotation, and we're even seeing it even today in what's been pretty choppy trading so far. Take us through a little bit. I mean, I don't want you to spend too much time on the past, because everybody on the call, plus anybody who's going to listen to this podcast, has heard Andrew and I talk about how negative positioning got in 2022.
Yep.
What's happening right now? And if you want to bring in kind of Rebecca's work on flows as sure. you talk about this, that's fine too.
Yep. Again, I think there's probably two points to this, right? So there's the positioning side, and then there's also like the positioning in rates and how that will matter, right? So again, we know that people were very cautious, if not negatively positioned. And further, where they were positioned, they were positioned defensively. Now, I made this statement that actually what's happening is equities and rates are actually telling us largely the same thing, and it's rational. It's just what we didn't think would happen. So here's what I mean by that, and I'll tie that back into the positioning story. So as you just alluded to, Tom, basically starting 10 days ago on that very strong jobs number, I think it was the third, that caused investors to question, should they be pricing in cuts by the Fed, right? And again, we've seen improving home builder confidence, improving home buyer traffic, better consumer and CEO sentiment, better car buying confidence, and really transitioning from this notion of hard landing to soft landing, and now some people are even talking about no landing, which means central banks have to continue to raise rates. Now, what's priced in? The market is actually now ahead of the Fed in terms of hikes. And so specifically what we're looking at is there's a meeting in March. We are fully priced for a 25 basis point hike. There's another one in May. And right now, the market price is in about 21 basis points, so largely priced. What's new and different is in June, there's a meeting, and we're about half priced. And in July, they're flirting with the idea of a hike. Now, compare that to before the strong jobs number. We were one hike, and we were done. And we were two cuts by the end of the year. Now, we're three, potential for three hikes, and we've removed at least one, if not two cuts. So our Fed rate is actually slightly higher than what the Fed themselves is calling for. That's now priced in. So please remember that part. The next part to remember is, I'm sure everybody tells you about the curve being inverted, and that's a recessionary indicator, right? And so the 2-year is higher than the 10-year. By about 87 basis points.
Crazy.
Okay, yes, but it is all because of the 2-year being so high. The 10-year is at like 377. There's two parts that go into the 10-year. There is inflation in what's priced in and growth in what's priced in. So we're largely pricing in, and then the inflation side, right, that's roughly called the break-even. That's right around 2%. That means growth is priced at about 1.75% over the next 10 years. Okay. Trend growth in the US is somewhere around 2%. So the rates market, the 10-year, is telling you that, yeah, growth might slow, but it's not a disaster. And if growth is slow, but it's not a disaster, then you're actually supposed to buy growth stocks, and you're probably supposed to buy profitable growth stocks. So that's, I think, therefore, right, with the straight face, I can say the rates market and the equity market are telling you roughly the same thing, that in the near term, the Fed has more work to do because the economy is proving to be stronger, but they don't have to destroy it. So growth will slow, but be moderate. And then that's just the exact opposite of what we thought was going to happen. And nobody was positioned for it.
Can you talk a little bit about the flows data that we see? I find it to be very unique in the research world. And I think what Rebecca's done is I would say groundbreaking, but pretty cool.
And as do the institutional client base, as does the institutional client base in terms of thinking it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And if I shared with you her Rolodex and like who wants to call her, it's pretty fancy, which I'm happy for her about. So this woman's name is Rebecca Chung. She works in our derivatives business, and she monitors and tracks, we call it market internals. Who are the incremental buyers? Who are the incremental sellers? Some of this stuff is very clear, and that's what you might get to read in the press. And some of the stuff is really hard to understand. So she will look at the market and say, for instance, our systematic or quant funds. There are, in broad general terms, there's CTAs, there are momentum traders, there's risk control, where they try and control the overall level of volatility in their portfolio, and there's risk parity, so they treat each asset class to the same level of volatility. They are all mechanical buyers or sellers of stocks. The best way for you and the audience to think about this is a risk control fund, and this is a generalization, mm-hmm. a risk control fund buys like they are taking an escalator, right? So they buy slowly on the way up, but when realized volatility spikes, they cut like they take the elevator down. So escalator slow and steady on the way up, elevator on the way down. So as an example, or as a for instance, risk control came into the year at one of the lowest weightings of equities. They're now at the highest level of equities that they've been at since their peak in 2021. They've bought, as again, estimate 35 to 40 billion of stock over the past 2 weeks, and will remain a buyer so long as realized volatility is like 50 bips to 75 bips, but they'll buy incrementally less than they have been. Now, back to the flows question, at some point, you know, for you on the crowd, Tom or Andrew will call you and say, this feels like a systematic unwind. And if, for instance, we got a big drawdown down, I don't know why it would happen, but if we were to, they could sell like 135 to 150 billion in a week.
Yeah. And which so we have seen in the past.
Which is what we have absolutely seen in the past. And that was, you know, especially during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Now, to give folks some comfort, right, so we don't just scare. So although the systematic funds are more exposed or levered or own more equities than they have, your active fund managers are 2 standard deviations below their averages. So your active fund manager has been selling into this rally. And just for some rough numbers, Keith Parker and Strategy tracks about 800 funds. That's close to $8 trillion in assets under management. If you file a daily performance figure and you say what your benchmark is, he and his team can reverse engineer what you're overweight or underweight by sector. And over the past 3 weeks, active managers have been selling into this rally and are now very much underweight. So to bring it back, why didn't we sell off more yesterday with a very strong CPI and today with a still strong consumer? We were positioned for it. And lo and behold, our desk activity, we're like 65% better to buy. It's long only funds. And that's kind of what you would hope for.
Yeah. Well, eventually, right, that active manager has a benchmark that they have to own, right? So it seems to me at least a little bit, in a very, I'm going to generalize and make simple all the work, but we're chasing a little bit here because we're on the wrong side of what our expectations were. And I think we were laughing right before we started the call, you know, the market's likely to make the most people feel silly at the most inconvenient time. So that's a little bit of that is happening.
Well, I mean, again, like this was the least likely scenario was that China would reopen, Europe would avoid a recession, and that the U.S. economy would show signs of life, if not even reaccelerate.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, that's where it appears that we're at right now.
Yes, exactly. As the data can change, as we know, at a moment's notice.
Yep.
So you talked a little bit about risk parity, risk control, and you mentioned the asset classes for your risk. So just for everybody that's listening, Greg means equity, foreign exchange, interest rates, credit, and commodities. Did I do that justice?
Yep, that's right.
Fantastic. Yep. So from a tactical perspective, one of the things, in addition to obviously the repositioning from what was a terrible year in 22, we've also seen a massive sector rotation out of the defensive names and into, more growth or profitable growth names. And we've got two sectors that have been pretty good for us in the last few years, staples and healthcare, actually negative for the year. And I don't want to phrase this the wrong way for the insight that you're providing through KNET, but God, have those businesses, do they just suck now, Greg?
So that's a technical term.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think, no, right? But they were guilty of, this is what people owned, this is where people were hiding. Mm. They had everything that you would potentially like, right? They were paying a dividend. Mm-hmm. They'll still pay a dividend. They had pricing power. They still have pricing power. They were passing along higher costs. They're still passing along higher costs. They're just doing so at a slower rate. And the market, right, can be a change of the change story. So the change of the change for those companies is going the wrong way, right? Their multiples relative to the S&P 500 hit all-time highs. Profitable technology, their multiple went from 59 times to 30 times. Now, you can say 30 times is still too expensive, but it did get cut in half.
Yeah, which we have also seen before.
Yeah.
And those businesses are also still okay. I don't know about Andrew, but I'm pretty sure Microsoft's going to be around through the end of the year.
Yep.
So the institutional trading that moves those markets so quickly, right? We're looking at that and then we ask ourselves, well, how does performance look so far this year? I know for us, right, we try and keep things simple for clients. So our core portfolio looks a ton like Dividend Ruler, right? But in the fourth quarter of 2022, we outperformed the S&P by 500 basis points. And here in the first 6 weeks of 2023, we're underperforming by 350 basis points. As if to say, those defensive names, healthcare, staples that benefited as people were getting really, really defensive into the end of the year, now everything's changed. When you look at performance like that across the institutions and you're hearing from people, what are you looking for and how is that impacting decisions that you're helping clients make for the coming quarter? Because it's a little bit different, right? You're moving way faster than we would move for private client, right?
Yep. So I think there's a couple of things to just point out because the performance numbers that are out there are staggering, right? So just first off, just big broad market terms, the NASDAQ is up 15% year to date. If anybody told you that they had that trade on January 1st because they thought it would be up that much, they're lying. And they probably wrote it a considerable way down. Mm. If I take performance, like to just say institution, I think is hard. And so if I divide it up long only compared to hedge fund and then further break down hedge fund, long only, it looks probably relatively similar to you. Obviously up on the year, just maybe not up as much as their benchmark. And the reason would be, again, that tech out performance that was harder to hold on to. Your platform hedge fund shops, right? So the multi-manager of the world, they are anywhere between down 50 bips to up 3.5%. Just they do it on a much lower volatility measure. And so they're doing what they're supposed to do. Your long short growth hedge fund, which was the poster child for what really, really underperformed last year, is not surprisingly having a really good start to the year. So quant funds actually had a very difficult time in those big sector rotations that you were talking about, and maybe exacerbated those moves. So they're maybe a little bit worse. And your macro hedge fund is back to showing some disparity. Lots of people made money on a weaker dollar trade. Some people have caught this most recent move in rates. Last year, there were signs where the industry was in distress. This year, it doesn't feel like they're in distress. They might not be performing as well as they'd like to, but it feels okay out there performance-wise.
So here's the crazy question. I don't want to put you completely on the spot, but this comes from one of our clients. So does this trend continue? And if so, for how long?
So what can continue and what's over? Coming into the year, right? Very big short base, very big defensive position, very big underweight tech. Let me put some numbers on that. We've got one particular business that we call retail market making. So it's not the UBS wealth management platform outside of that, right, where we help trade for them. In the month of December, that retail market making business sold stock for 24 straight days. We estimate that they sold 2/3 of the stock that they had bought from the March 2020 pandemic lows during that time, largely tax loss harvesting. In the month of January, we think they bought 50 to 60% of that back. So that's probably largely behind us, that retail selling and coming back for tax reasons. The sector rotation that we saw that the quants exacerbated, that feels to us again like that has largely run its course. So in order for things to continue, I think you need to be thinking about, again, like the outlook for growth and who can actually grow earnings. And so like the notion of a profitable tech company, why are they going up when they're announcing job cuts? It's a little bit like when the energy sector said, we're no longer going to just put money back into the ground. We're going to return capital to shareholders. And that was kind of the turning point. These are great companies. They can be free cash flow machines. They were just hiring too much or thought that those growth trends would continue forever. They're coming back to trend, and Andrew will be here to fight another day and a week and a month. So that profitable tech story probably has legs.
Interesting. And obviously, earnings for the fourth quarter have shown that the travel, leisure, hospitality aspect of the U.S. economy seems to be doing quite well, which showed up in the jobs figures as well. So the consumer, at least in our consumption economy, based on the current data, seems to be a surprising shining light in an otherwise negative backdrop. Is that a good way to phrase that?
Yeah, it might want to challenge the negative backdrop as well, but let's unpack that a little bit, right? So for those on the line, just go and look at airlines, travel, hospitality, and look up any of those companies and look at their earnings that they've reported over the past 3 weeks. It is gangbusters amazing. How much more room does that have to go is a legitimate question to ask. One way to think about it, which one of my clients posed to me a couple of days ago, Hawaii is obviously the most service-led economy of any of the states. Going into the pandemic, they had the lowest unemployment rate. During the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic, they've had the highest unemployment rate, and they haven't yet gotten back to trend. So what's priced into stocks can be a different question, but that's an interesting observation and mind model for how much more services has to run and the pricing that they have seen. The other part of the economy, which is just proving to be far more resilient than anybody thought, is reshoring and the regrowing of the U.S. manufacturing footprint. And for instance, U.S. reshoring announcements in Q4 were up 17% quarter on quarter. If I used a different metric, It's 4 times greater now than it was in 2019, which is remarkable. Or if I looked at it one other way, U.S. manufacturing construction is up 45% year on year versus broader non-residential at only up 10. So there's like two parts of the economy that are showing remarkable stability, because I'm rolling here. There was also firms like us on the institutional side host conferences for investors, and they're usually done by sector. So this week, some of our competitors were talking about the financial services industry. High-profile CEO said if you look at the lowest cohort of our consumer and you look at their balances in their account, they are still 3 times higher now than they were pre-pandemic. So, by the way, the unemployment rate is 3.6% or something like that. So people still have jobs and they're still spending, and that can turn on a dime or it can be fully priced in. But to your point, there's parts of this economy that are just proving far more resilient than we had thought.
And parts of the economy that probably feel recessionary, right? That non-profitable tech startup world probably feels very recessionary if that's your part of the economy. But in the aggregate, right, the data would support the fact that generally the economy has been stronger than people anticipated, at least through this point. So we've said a couple of different ways, like things can change on a dime. I think a lot of that is true. What are the things that you think about, or even some of the people in your areas think about in terms of being like leading indicators? Are there a handful of things that you are like, I watch this and I'm watching that? Or
so investors have wanted to rotate into credit, right? And fixed income. And they started to do that late Q4 and certainly into this year. And there's two or three things that, again, on this risk call that I was telling you about, that our credit traders were saying. So first point is, if you look at investment grade credit or high yield, and these trade relative to rates, right? So it's called a spread.
Spread to treasury.
Yeah.
Right.
So investment grade is currently closer to how tight it was in 2021 when things were great than it is to 2022 when things were bad, right? So investment grade spreads are relatively tight. They've widened a little bit, but they're relatively tight. When I look at new issues, right? So an investment grade company issues a new bond. When that paper, that new bond comes to market, it will either be richer or cheaper than what's already trading.
Mm-hmm.
If it's cheaper, right, it's called a concession. That's the normal way of the market. Well, last week, the majority of the new issue deals that came to market came with a quote negative concession. They traded tighter than what was already existing in the secondary market for the same company and similar, you know, length. So that tells you that the fundamentals or the inflows into the market are incredibly good.
Mm-hmm.
Scares me a little bit, right?
Right, there's demand.
Right. So much demand that, like, could that get worse? The other one, if you look at where like a 6-month treasury bill is trading compared to a BBB credit with like 8 years of maturity, that spread is as tight as it's been since 1981.
Mm.
So again, I don't know how tight it's supposed to be or how wide it's supposed to be, but anytime you start saying the tightest since, you know, the early 80s, that means a lot of goodness is probably priced in there. So I'm mindful of those two things. So mindful of inflows into credit and will that slow? Mindful of how tight government debt is trading to high yield. Could that widen out? I think those are big indicators for me. And for
always like to remind everybody on the call, whenever we talk about spreads widening or contracting, this can happen two different ways, right? IG credit could widen because credit conditions are deteriorating and companies need to pay more, or they could stay the same and that 6-month treasury bill could come down as the Fed lowers interest rates. But spreads can correct two different ways. Or they can do both at the same time.
Yes. And so, like, what will that mean for risk appetite? So mm-hmm. trying to pay a lot of attention to that.
Okay. Interesting. We have no more questions from the audience. So is there anything that you want to leave us with, Greg?
To round out, like, the risk conversation and risk potentially negative catalyst, I'm surprised that the debt ceiling didn't come up because mm-hmm. it has come up in most conversations. Mm-hmm. It's our political expert's opinion that we will take this down to the wire because we can't help ourselves. What I worry about in the debt ceiling debate is right now the Treasury is using their piggy bank. It's called the TGA. The Treasury General Account, and they are spending money down from that. So they're adding liquidity into the system. As and when the debt ceiling gets passed, Treasury needs to rebuild their coffers, right? They need to rebuild the TGA. So they will be sucking liquidity out of the system. That can be a risk for markets. We've seen that happen before. We've seen Japan and a new potential Bank of Japan governor, how they decide to exit yield curve control, or if they decide to exit lower interest rates, that can have a knock-on impact. It's probably a step too far for right now. The outlook for earnings, you know, the headline number is people are looking for earnings to be down 4% Q on Q. It looks like it's actually going to come in better than that with what we know right now. That would be the big stuff.
Very cool. Well, Andrew, I, Jill, everybody on the team, and all our clients who joined us today, thank you for your time, Greg. I'll listen to what you have to say. Well, I will listen to you tomorrow.
That's right.
I hope you have a wonderful time with your family. A well-earned vacation for sure.
I really appreciate it. Everyone, thanks for dialing in. Jill, Tom, Andrew, thank you for the partnership, and hopefully we can do this again real soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Greg.
Take care. Bye.